Welcome back to the Classical Theism Podcast, Episode 15. Today we sit down with Catholic apologist Carlo Broussard to discuss an existential proof of God's existence, as well as the problem of divine hiddenness. Stay tuned, it's going to be a great episode. Hi, I'm John DeRosa, and you're listening to the Classical Theism Podcast, where we defend Catholic Christian ideas in conversation, and love the God of classical theism with all of our heart and all of our mind. Welcome back to the Classical Theism Podcast, where we glorify the God of classical theism and defend Catholic Christian ideas in conversation. Remember, our goal here is to make you, the listeners, with this intermediate apologetics material, make you equipped to be Catholic case makers, go out there and defend three pillars of Catholic Christian ideas, defend the fact that God exists, that Jesus is our Lord and Messiah, and that he founded the Catholic Church. I've got a great episode for you today. A great guest, Carlo Broussard from Catholic Answers, joins us to present an existential proof for God's existence and to talk a little bit about the problem of divine hiddenness. Now, I want to tell you ahead of time a couple things. The show notes page for this episode is going to be packed with some important information. I include some terms there as well. Some of the abstract terms that Carlo uses, such as essay, essence, the real distinction between essence and existence. I catalog that there with a nice little summary to help you along in the episode if you need it. And the show notes page is going to be classicaltheism.com/Carlo, K-A-R-L-O, classicaltheism.com/Carlo. Also, I linked to a talk from Dr. Edward Faser on the real distinction between essence and existence. If you want to go into real, like a deep dive into more detail on that premise, on the idea of there being essence and existence, or as Carlo is going to use the word esse, which is the Latin word for a thing's act of being, that it has, in order to exist, it has to have some act of being. If you want to deep dive into those ideas, you can check out the lecture I linked to on the show notes page. And last but not least, and then we're going to dive right into the interview, Carlo Broussard's got an awesome book out, great apologetics book called Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. And I'm going to be giving away a free copy of that book, and you can enter to win a free copy. Just stay tuned to the end of the episode, and you can find out more about that. Without further ado, let's head into the interview. I'm joined by Carlo Broussard, a native of southern Louisiana who left a promising musical career to devote himself full-time to the work of Catholic apologetics. As a staff apologist and speaker at Catholic Answers, he travels the country giving talks on apologetics, the Bible, theology, and philosophy. Carlo holds undergraduate and graduate degrees in theology and is working on his master's in philosophy. He also worked for several years with nationally known author and philosopher Father Robert J. Spitzer at the Magis Center. Carlo is one of the most dynamic and gifted Catholic speakers on the circuit today, communicating with precision of thought and a genuine love for God, and of course, an enthusiasm that inspires. Carlo Broussard, welcome to the Classical Theism Podcast.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me, brother.
Now, Carlo, you have a great book out called Prepare the Way. What led you to write this book, and what can readers expect from it?
Yeah, well, Prepare the Way is obviously the motif of John the Baptist, right? A voice crying out in the wilderness, prepare a way for the Lord, lowering mountains, filling the valleys. And I've often reflected upon how the ministry of apologetics is very similar to the ministry of John the Baptist. Because in apologetics, we find ourselves often having to constantly sort of trailblaze away, right? To get rid of the brush, to remove obstacles, misconceptions, etc. Sometimes it's the presence of something like evil in the world. Sometimes it's the absence of something, such as I don't see any good evidence for God, right? So whether it's a mountain or a valley, we either have to lower the mountain or fill the valley to prepare a way for our Lord, who's approaching people, unbelievers and skeptics, with the gifts of truth and life. And so God has bestowed upon us a great dignity to be able to participate in his providential plan to work with him to prepare a way for him. God doesn't need us. He didn't need John the Baptist. But yet he bestowed a great dignity upon John the Baptist to be that voice crying out in the wilderness to prepare a way. He bestows upon us a great dignity to be evangelizers, to prepare a way, to prepare the hearts of folks for the coming of our Lord into their heart, right? And so what I wanted to do with this book, John, was, you know, for so long since the revival of apologetics, it's always been centered on the Catholic-Protestant dialogue. And there are a plethora of books out there that deal with Mary, the papacy, the saints, etc. But there are very few and far in between books that sort of catalog the common questions that unbelievers and skeptics ask us as Catholics. So I wanted to, I mean, we have the great book of, you know, Craft and Ticelli, a handbook of Christian apologetics, but that's like, oh my goodness, it's overwhelming, you know, so many arguments. How could I remember this stuff? So I wanted to try and present a condensed version of that. And in the book, what I do, John, is I coach you, the Catholic, who's willing to go out and evangelize, right? I'm coaching you in strategies on how to remove obstacles that people face when it comes to truth, God, Jesus, Christianity as a religion, and the church. So, for example, how can I believe in truth, absolute truth, when people believe so many different things, right? You know, why would I affirm truth when that's just intolerant to do that, right? That's mean-spirited. How do we respond? How can I believe in God when there's so much evil? How can I believe in Jesus when I can't even trust the Gospels? Those sorts of obstacles that people face, I train you in strategies with Socratic questions in order to remove those obstacles to prepare that way for the Lord.
Very good. Well, in the book, you cover a lot of ground and provide excellent strategies for defending God, Jesus, and the church. It's really well written. There's a ton of information jam-packed into the footnotes as well, or the endnotes. And I'm just curious, you cover so much ground. What were some of your favorite sections to write in that book?
Yeah, well, I'll be honest with you. My favorite section to write was the section dealing with the problem of evil and the problem of divine hiddenness, which is one of the topics we'll be talking about today in the broadcast here. It was a challenging section, I must admit, but I was excited to try and present answers to the problem of evil from a Thomistic perspective. Because within contemporary philosophy and natural theologians who deal with the problem of evil, it's very contemporary. There's a lot of awesome approaches and strategies to deal with it. But when I started reading Thomas Aquinas and, of course, authors who comment on Thomas Aquinas, Thomistic authors, I was intrigued and just totally intellectually satisfied with sort of a Thomistic approach to addressing the problem of evil. And so what I wanted to do, John, is I wanted to try to do whatever I could do, right? I'm still in training, man. I'm still working on this stuff. But I wanted to do something to try to introduce to folks who read the book sort of these Thomistic principles. Now, I'm not outright saying this is Thomas Aquinas approach type of thing, you know, but those principles are inspiring the way in which I'm approaching the problem of evil and the problem of divine hiddenness. So as much as it was the most challenging part of the book, because I had to rewrite quite a bit when I was critiqued and stuff and editing in the editing process, it was the most challenging, but it was the most joy-filled section to write because that's sort of a section, a topic that everybody deals with, both believers and unbelievers alike. So I was kind of satisfied and overjoyed to do that part of the book.
Well, thank you for including that section. Like you said, we're going to talk about God's existence and divine hiddenness today, but I might even have to have you back on again sometime to talk about the problem of evil and suffering, because those
are some
of the best chapters. I will say I was pumped up. I don't think I've picked up an apologetics book yet that was citing Father Brian Davis and that was citing Father Herbert McCabe on those subjects. So I think you're one of the first ones to do it. So I was happy to see that.
Only a classical theist would know that.
Hey, our audience is aware of these type of things.
Amen.
So today we're talking about God's existence and the problem of divine hiddenness. First, we'll talk about God's existence, which you give a nice argument for in the book. And I was curious if you could kind of classify or situate the argument for us. Do you call it a contingency argument? Is it more of a Thomistic proof? Like in Fazer's Five Proofs, he calls it the Thomistic proof, one of them.
Yeah.
Give us a bird's eye view of how you view the argument and how you classify it.
Yeah, so I would classify it as a Thomistic proof that Fazer presents in his Five Proofs of the Existence of God, which by the way is, oh my gosh, it's an excellent resource, right? It's like the Bible of natural theology, man. But it's based on Aquinas's proof in the De Ente et Essentium, being in essence. And I mean, we could call it like a contingency proof if you define contingency as, you know, something that's dependent upon something else for its very act of being, which distinguishes it from nothing. Now, that's not how Aquinas would articulate it, because in Aquinas's vocabulary, a contingent being is synonymous to a corruptible being, because for Aquinas, angels are necessary beings. Even the nature of the spiritual human soul as a subsistent being, subsistent in itself, given that it exists, it can't be corrupted or generated. It's a necessary being, right? But if you define contingency just in the sense of dependence, existential dependence, you might say, dependence for essay, you could classify it as that. And basically what it's doing is it starts with the mundane experience of things, as Aquinas does, and it looks at something and the intellect immediately recognizes being, esse, right? This is something that's distinct from nothing. It has some principle by which it is not nothing but something. And of course, when you analyze that, that principle is the act of being itself, right? And so we have to ask the question, well, and I lay this out in the book, right, in step-by-step strategies.
Absolutely. And I was going to say, if you're off to a great start here, the premises themselves, I think, are definitely more important with how we classify it. But that makes sense with the Thomistic version. Can you go through a few of those steps with us, a few of the steps of the premises, and just give us an overview of how you defend it?
Sure, yeah, I'll do that. So here's the argument in sketched form. Premise one, if everything was caused to exist by something else, then there would be an infinite series of existential caused causes. What that means is a cause that is caused to exist. It has its active being by virtue of the causal power of something else, right? And the infinite series that I'm speaking of here is, you know, as your classical theist listeners are very aware of, would be an essentially ordered series, right? An ordered series per se versus an accidentally ordered series, an ordered series per accidens, right? Such as the grandfather, the father, and the grandson type of thing. We're talking about like the chain that's holding up the flower pot suspended in air. We're talking about rather than the dominoes being lined up from left to right horizontally, they're lined up or stacked up vertically. So that's the type of ordered series of causes that we have in mind here. And I spell that out. I flesh that out in the chapter. So premise one, if everything was caused to exist by something else, there would be an infinite series of existential caused causes. Premise two, but there cannot be an infinite series of existential caused causes. Therefore, not everything can be caused to exist by something else. There must exist at least one existential cause that doesn't have to receive its existence from something outside itself, an uncaused cause, right? And such a reality is what we call God. And when you unpack that, you know, the very starting point with esse, and whenever you arrive at the concept that something's esse or active being is not identical to its essence, its esse or its active being is distinct from what it is in its essence, well, then when you arrive at that uncaused cause, it immediately follows that the uncaused cause, active esse or active being, right, is identical to its essence. So you have existence and essence being identical in this uncaused cause. It's of metaphysical necessity. So in order to, I mean, the premise that does the most work, right, is premise two. There cannot be an infinite series of existential caused causes. And so I try to flesh that out in the book to show why you can't have an infinite series of existential causes ordered in an essential way. And here's the reason, John.
This is huge coming up. I just want to signal to the listeners, because there's actually, you know, there's a lot of philosophers through the ages who think Aquinas begs the question in some of his arguments and other people, because they say he just asserts that there can't be an infinite chain of caused causes, or, you know, in some other form, an infinite chain of moved movers. And Carlo, you're about to give us a reason behind that. It's not just an assertion, it's something that we can support. So this is a crucial moment, right? And I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Okay, so the answer to the, you know, the puzzle, the solution to the puzzle depends on an understanding of how finite creatures or how things that we experience do not have esse by nature. Their esse is distinct from their nature, right? And obviously, as I point out in the book, we can know that. The tree outside, there was a time when it didn't exist, and there's a time when it won't exist. Therefore, we know it doesn't have its active being by nature, because if it did, it would always exist, right? So I know from that observation and that philosophical analysis that its esse or its active being is distinct from its nature. It doesn't belong to its nature to exist, right? So that means, lest you violate the principle of sufficient reason, that means it must receive its esse from something outside itself, right? Okay, now watch this. If we postulate a series of existential caused causes ordered in an essential way, John, then there no cause in the series has existence by nature, right? Because every single one of them is a caused cause. It's receiving esse from something outside of itself. It doesn't have it by nature. But if no cause in the series has esse by nature, then there is no source from which the causes can actually receive the act of being itself. And so literally, you have nothing from which these causes receive esse. So something is coming from nothing. And so you can see how it reduces to the first principles of knowledge, the first principle of causality and the principle of sufficient reason, because you would have to say that there is nothing to distinguish these causes having esse rather than not having esse. But if there's nothing to distinguish these causes from having esse rather than not having esse, then there would be no esse. There would be no active being. So the causes would have no active being in the first place. And if that's the case, then the ultimate effect of the essentially ordered series of existential cause causes would not have esse, namely the tree, namely you, namely me. But obviously, that's not the case. The tree does have esse. It is distinguished from nothing. You exist. I exist. We are distinguished from nothing. Therefore, in this chain of existential caused causes, there must be some cause, at least one cause, that does have esse by nature, that is a source from which esse can be derived. Such a cause doesn't receive esse from outside of something else, by something outside of itself, because it simply belongs to its nature to exist. Its nature is to be. Such an uncaused cause, whose existence is identical to its essence, is what we call God. And it is that cause whose causal activity is necessary for you, I, and the tree to have esse right here and right now, without which we would lapse into nothingness. So that's a sketch of this, what some philosophers call an existential proof, arguing from esse and arriving to an uncaused cause whose esse is identical to its essence. That's what we call God, ipsum esse subsistens, right?
Fantastic. Well, Carl, your energy on this point is contagious. I love it. And I think you've defended that premise well. It can get a bit abstract. I mean, these are, you know, these notions of esse and active being and just calling it a hierarchical chain of causes or essentially ordered series of causes. It can get very abstract. But what I like that you do in the book is you don't shy away from giving that terminology, yet you tie it to some concrete examples as well. Could you just, I think you named a couple of them before, maybe like the chain or the boxcars. Could you just kind of tie in those illustrations or those examples you use to make that point?
Yeah. So, for example, an accidentally ordered series of causes would be the grandfather who begets the father who begets the grandson type of thing, right? Well, guess what? When grandson exercises his generating activity, the generating activity of grandpa is not essential to the generating activity of grandson right here and right now, right?
That's right.
Thanks be to God, right? Grandpa can die, but yet grandson can still generate his exercise his generating activity. You know, in the series of dominoes, you can knock over the first domino and that 100th domino can still fall over, even though the first domino is already done and over in its motion. An essentially ordered series of causes is one in which the effect and every cause in the series is at right here and right now dependent on the causal activity of every other cause in the series. So the links in the chain that are holding up the flower pot, you have link one holding up the flower pot, but it can only hold up the flower pot in as much as it's being held up by link two and link three on up to the bracket in the ceiling upon which the links are fastened, right? Or the cup that's suspended in midair due to the tabletop of my desk, which is suspended in midair right here and right now due to the legs of the desk, which is suspended in mid, you know, suspended above the ground due to the floor of my house, which is supported by the very ground of the earth, right? That's what we're talking about in an essentially ordered series. And it's that type of series that cannot regress infinitely when we're talking about essay, when we're talking about motion, when we're talking about any sort of thing or feature that's causally dependent upon others. You eventually have to arrive at some cause that is the source from which that particular feature is derived, in this case essay. And it's that source is going to have that feature, that actuality, by its very nature, not being actualized by anything outside of itself, but being pure actuality. Because if it is actualized by something outside of itself, well, then it's simply one more cause in the series, and thus does not explain why the causes in the series have the actuality in the first place.
I think it's a very cool argument, a good argument to help prepare someone's way who doesn't think there are good arguments for God's existence.
Yeah.
And what you've laid out is what Fazer calls stage one, the fact that we must get down to a source of pure actuality, of underived causal power, as you mentioned, a source whose essay is not distinct from its existence. But what a common objection comes that follows from that, and this will be the last kind of objection I throw at you on this topic, why do you think that's God? Why say that underived, you know, source of causal power of existence, why call that God? Why not just say it's like space-time or, you know, some fundamental particles?
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, it does require philosophical analysis to unpack the meaning or that which is contained in the concept of pure essay. Being whose essay is identical to its essence. We have to unpack the various traditional divine attributes. So starting with like immateriality, we know such a being or such a reality must be immaterial, because if it were material, it would have, I mean, there's various ways you could do this, but if it were material, well, then it wouldn't be pure essay. Why? Because it would not only have essay, but it would have the material principle added to its active existence. So it would be essay plus, it would have an active existence plus the material principle that defines its essence, right? And so, thus, it wouldn't be pure essay, it would be a composed or a composite being. But pure essay is absolutely simple being, right? You cannot have essay plus some other factor. It has to be just pure essay. Because if it has some other factor and it is a composite, this gets back to another Thomistic principle, actually getting back to Plato, right? That every composite being requires a composer, right? Because the two components are in potency to one another, and in order for that potential to be actualized, it must be actualized by something outside of the two factors or the two principles, right? So pure essay can't be material, because otherwise it would be a composite, but pure essay can't be a composite, therefore pure essay is not material, right? And then we would go on, once again, with absolute simplicity, we could deduce intelligence, right? Because as Aquinas would talk, the more and more you get away from matter, the closer, you know, the more and more you get to intelligence. Something that's purely immaterial and pure essay would be pure intelligence itself. And then with intelligence comes will. And then with pure essay being pure actual power, you have omnipotence, right? Because there's nothing that goes beyond its causal power of giving being, right? And then on through down the line. And in the book, I actually, in step seven, I give you sort of summary syllogisms on how to unpack these divine attributes, from this concept of pure esse, or a reality whose existence is identical to its essence.
I think that's excellent, and you provide some nice citations as well. I love the way you close out that chapter with the stage two, talking about the divine attributes, and then you end with this nice quote from the First Vatican Council to really kind of put the seal on what we're saying here when we're doing this philosophy. And I'm just going to read it for the listeners. It says, quote, "The same Holy Mother Church holds and teaches that God, the source and end of all things, can be known with certainty from the consideration of created things by the power of natural, or by the power of human reason," end quote. So I think this is a good step in the right direction of preparing someone's way to know God. But Carlo, I want to get your ear on another topic. I know we have about 5 to 10 more minutes here, if you're willing to spend with us. I'd like to talk about the problem of divine hiddenness. And you title that chapter with a great question. You say, "Why believe in God when he never shows himself to me?" Can you elaborate on the problem and give a few strategies that you prescribe to tackle this?
Sure. Well, the problem of divine hiddenness can be sort of divided into two aspects. Like, one question is, okay, well, if God is all loving, why doesn't he manifest himself to me in such a way that I can't do anything but choose him and be in a relationship with him and preclude the possibility of choosing evil like the blessed in heaven? And I don't address that specifically in this chapter. I actually address it in an appendix in the book where I give reasons why it's reasonable to think that God chose to create us without the beatific vision rather than with the beatific vision. Because the only way for us to be able to be in a relationship with him without the possibility of choosing evil is if he reveals his essence to us, right? But the other question is, okay, well, maybe he doesn't have to do that, but at least he could manifest himself to me in such a way that he exists and thus leave the room for me to make a choice whether to follow him or not, right? But at least my intellect could not help but assent to the proposition God exists, right? And that's sort of the aspect or the version of the problem of divine hiddenness that I address in my book. And first of all, in the strategy, first strategy, John, I just point out that at least we can say God's not obligated in order to be good, right? In order for something to cohere with his goodness, God is not obligated to give us absolute indubitable evidence where, you know, there's no possible doubt. All he has to give us is what is called intellectual indubitable evidence. That is evidence that precludes prudent doubt, right? Like, for example, we can just use the example of, you know, a guy and a girl, they're engaged and they're fixing to get married. The guy has, you know, he doesn't have absolute indubitable evidence that his wife, that his fiance loves him, right? But he has good reason to think that she loves him. And that's all that's needed to for it to be reasonable for him to marry her, right? So too, it's befitting of God's goodness that he would only give us intellectual indubitable evidence that would preclude prudent doubt rather than all doubt, right? And when we have that good evidence that he exists, well, then it's reasonable to direct our lives toward him. So that's the first strategy that I point out. It's not reasonable to demand that God give us absolute indubitable evidence in order for it to be reasonable for us to follow him or direct our lives to him. Now, what I found interesting, John, you know, getting back to all the Thomistic stuff, one thing I found in my research is that a Thomistic approach to the problem of divine hiddenness, and I point this out in strategy too, is that it belongs to man's nature as a rational rational animal to engage in rational inquiry, intellectual inquiry, right? It simply belongs to our nature as man. And it's befitting of God's goodness to relate to us in accord with our nature, right? It's befitting of his goodness to relate to us, to allow for us to do what we are meant to do by nature, namely rational inquiry. We're not angels. We're not pure spirits that get knowledge by infusion. We're rational animals, which implies that we must arrive at knowledge of the truth through rational inquiry. And of course, with that comes the possibility of making mistakes and making erroneous judgments. God could give us the evidence in such a way that the intellect must assent to his existence, but he doesn't. Does that contradict his goodness? No. Why? Because it belongs to our nature to engage in rational inquiry, and it's befitting of God's goodness for him to relate to us in such a manner. You see? And then finally, in strategy three, I point out how the rational inquiry could very well be the condition for us seeing the indubitableness of the evidence, right? To make our knowledge of him once we arrive at the truth more certain. I mean, think of math class, right, John? Your teacher always said, show your work, right?
If I'm a math teacher. I don't know if you knew that, really? So this works great.
Amen, brother. Yeah, you tell your students, don't you dare go look in the back of the book and look up the answer, right? Why must we work through the problem? So that when we arrive at the answer, we don't have to accept it on belief, on testimony. We don't have to believe it's true. We can know it's true because we've done the work. And similarly, I think a good argument can be made that God allows for us to engage in a rational inquiry so that when we do come to the knowledge of the truth, we know the truth, at least those truths we can know by the natural light of human reason, that we don't have to rely on testimony in order to know, right? Now, somebody might say, John, just real quick, somebody might say, well, what if I don't get there, right? Is God like going to send me to hell or something? And then I point out in the book, of course not, right? God knows the inner movements of the heart. And if somebody is honest in his intellectual inquiry and he simply is unable to arrive at the truth, God will work with that person and judge that person accordingly.
I like what you said with the math comparison, of course, but it really rings home for me. Recently, I was thinking, you know, in geometry class, we do all these theorems and proofs. You put up a theorem and the students learn the definition. A theorem is a statement that can be proven. But if it's already been proven, then why do we have to go through the exercise of proving it? You know, students are like, these proofs are hard. Man, I got to do these statements, these reasons. Why the heck do I have to do this? And it's that distinction that you just pointed out. There's a difference between just believing it on testimony or actually coming to see that it's true. And there's a great dignity involved that with in accord with our nature to actually go through that process and see that it's true. So I like the way you incorporate that into your defense. I'm just going to push back on one quick thing because someone might say there's still a little bit of a pastoral problem here. But like, yeah. If God's supposed to be a loving parent, I get that right. You're given these reasons, but couldn't he just easily show himself to me? Isn't it just unloving? You know, wouldn't you be an unloving parent if you just hid from your children and just let them be alone for weeks or months or years? What can we say to that type of objection?
Well, with the philosophy hat, I would say, yes, it would be unloving for me to do that because I have an obligation to my children in order to be present to them in such a way that they know I'm there and taking care of them and et cetera. But philosophically speaking, God, in being the infinite creator, as Aquinas would point out, he has no obligation to his creatures. There's no real relation on the part of the creator to the creature. The real relation only exists from the creature perspective related to the creator because we're dependent upon him for our existence. So that would be my first response. The objection assumes that God has an obligation to us, and since he doesn't fulfill that obligation, therefore he's not all good, right? So that would be sort of my philosophical approach. And then also too, my second answer can pull from both philosophy and theology and say, well, being that God is omniscient, right, and omnipotent, all-knowing and all-powerful, he could have good reason to not manifest himself to us in such a full-blown manner, good reason that we simply in our finite, limited intelligence cannot come to know. But if we were to know that good reason, we would see that it coheres with his all-loving nature, with his all-good nature. So just because we can't see or know or think of a good reason why God might hide himself a little bit, right? Rather than manifesting himself in all of his glory right here and right now, just because we can't see that good reason, it doesn't follow there is no good reason. And in order for his sort of hiddenness to cohere with his goodness, there must be good reason, but we have good reason to think there is such good reason, being that he's all good, all knowing, and all loving. And we know that on separate grounds, given the philosophical arguments for God's existence. And we can root ourselves in that and say, well, just because we can't see a good reason for his permission of this quote-unquote hiddenness, it doesn't follow there is no good reason. And it doesn't follow that it would contradict his all-good nature.
That's awesome, Carlo. Thank you so much for joining us on the Classical Theism podcast and sharing your expertise, your energy, your enthusiasm for classical theism. I mean, I'm pumped up. You're pumped up. I highly recommend Prepare the Way to the listeners. It contains a wealth of information. And then you go into the end notes. There's over like 300 end notes. You could be reading papers, extra books. All kinds of academic material is listed there, but it's presented in a readable way with the goal of using those strategies in conversation. So thank you so much for that. Is there anything else you want to add to listeners or anything else you want them to know about the book? And then where should they go to find out more about your work?
Yeah, well, I think we pretty much covered the elevator pitch of the book. You know, it's strategies to coach you in how to remove obstacles. Like you said, it is presented in a readable way. You know, it might be a little challenging here and there where you have to read it over again, especially when it pertains to the philosophical principles dealing with truth and the existence of God and stuff. But it is presented in a readable way. And the important point is there are Socratic questions embedded in the strategies to sort of help you guide the conversation along in order to highlight certain embedded ideas and lines of thinking, right? And to expose flaws in some of the erroneous ways of thinking, right? So that's an important element of the book, I would say. And then they can get the book at shop.catholic.com.
Fantastic. I'll have a link to that in the show notes page. And Carlo, thank you so much for joining us and teaching us a little bit more about how to defend Catholic Christian ideas in conversation. Thanks and have a good day.
Thank you, John.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Carlo Broussard. If you're interested in entering to win the free book, the free copy of Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church, head over to classicaltheism.com/Carlo. That's Carlo with a K, K-A-R-L-O, classicaltheism.com/Carlo. There you're going to find a button that says Enter to Win Free Book. Click on that button. You got to fill out a short survey, and you will automatically be entered to win. Make sure you put a good email address so I can contact you if you are the winner. And I look forward to another great discussion next week. What I decided to do is, because I know we covered the divine hiddenness problem pretty quickly here, only about, you know, maybe 7 or 8 minutes on that. I got Dr. Michael Ray from Notre Dame, who just wrote an entire book-length treatment on the problem of divine hiddenness, and we're going to interview him. He has some great work, and I think it relates directly to classical theism because he discusses how God's divine transcendence is a major factor and when we try to analyze this problem of divine hiddenness. So I think you're going to like what he has to say, and that'll be what's coming up next week. Thank you again so much for listening. If you have any, you know, love mail or hate mail, positive or negative feedback, please feel free to head over to the contact page, classicaltheism.com/contact. I will read everything there. I read all the emails, and I look forward to chatting with you next week. Have a great week, and please know, listeners, that I am praying for you.